bilateral relations or diplomatic negotiations, it will definitely also affect the standing of the legal and political arguments of China over the United States. The law that was interpreted yesterday is universal law that applies to all other countries. And again, this is validated by the fact that even China, the United States, actually came, had three opportunities to try to influence the thinking of the judges. And as we have seen yesterday, to a large extent, actually, the judges were quite explicit in rebuking some of the arguments that those major polluters led forward in order to evade accountability.
Well, Sebastian, finally, you have 30 seconds. The role of national courts. The BBC said lawyers could start bringing cases as early as next week in national courts.
Absolutely. This will embolden the plaintiffs, victims of climate harms, but also hopefully judges in being more responsive to the need to apply existing law in the context of climate change. What we really need is to end an era of impunity and just actually rely on existing legal principle to hold polluters accountable, whether they are corporates or governmental. So tomorrow we expect, or like from today, starting today, we expect a new era of climate accountability.
Sebastian Dyke, I want to thank you so much for being with us, senior attorney with the Center for International Environmental Law, known as CIEL, which supported countries and their arguments before the International Court of Justice. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are tuned into KBO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Friends of Noise, presenting a two-day music festival for the documentary No Quiet Hours, a focus on the DIY music scene in Oregon. The festival is Friday, July 25th and Saturday, July 26th, from 5 to 9 p.m. both days, and will feature food, arts and crafts, and a lineup of 8 bands from across the region. Tickets and info at friendsofnoise.org.
This is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests today are Amy Fellows and Jenny Canaday. They are disability rights advocates at the heart of multiple groups and projects. Amy is the executive director of We Can Do Better, and Jenny is the powerhouse activist mom, also organizing on these issues. Thanks for being here.
Thank you
for having us.
My friends, I have gone around and around with preparing for this interview and describing your work, but truly, you do so much. I'm just going to ask you to describe it. And if I get something wrong, please correct me immediately. And for the record, you both do a lot, so I can't totally blame myself for not being able to keep up with you for real, you guys. So let's start with Amy. Tell us about your work, and please describe every hat you wear.
Okay. I'm the executive director of We Can Do Better, which is a small statewide nonprofit that was started by former Governor Kitzhaber in 2006 as a healthcare civic engagement organization. And our board recently updated our mission statement to fit more the work that we're doing at this point. So that is that We Can Do Better connects with the lived experiences of Oregonians and the insights of community-led organizations with policymakers and system leaders. Through open bi-directional communication, we help build mutual understanding, driving meaningful collaboration. Together, we challenge the silos rooted in structural racism, ableism, and other bias by creating inclusive spaces for engaging, informing, and empowering communities. We Can Do Better promote systems change for a more equitable future for all.
I'm curious to ask you, if you just updated it, what did you evolve in your operations that you needed to update it? I'm super curious. I love evolution.
I think the evolution is really partially from my lived experience as a parent raising a disabled child and seeing how health and mental health are impacted by our siloed systems, our education system, which is creating a lot of mental health issues for children, you know, our disability system that doesn't look at mental health, just all the various silos. And so our annual conferences, we're more and more being informed by lived experience of myself and others. And so I wanted to not just be in that healthcare bucket, but really
trying to have conversations across the siloed systems uplift my siloed experience.
A little later, I want to talk about some of the other organizations that you're interacting with and some of these issues, because it really is blooming like a garden, it seems like to me. So you should be writing a book. Jenny, what do you do?
Yes, thank you. So I have been at this for a really long time. About 8 years ago, I started a little nonprofit called A Zany Life, named after my son, Zane. As a neurodivergent parent of three neurodivergent children, I've spent the last 15 years volunteering as an IEP advocate, supporting families at school meetings, which is very necessary because it's almost always a fight to get our children's needs met in school. In every space I enter, I'm always advocating for relationship-based supports and interventions. I think that's really the key to helping our system get out of the rank of almost the worst in the country for children's mental health. So my oldest son is blind and autistic. He's 29 years old. So I have many years of lived experience navigating ableism in systems. My son has experienced ableism almost every time he has walked out of our house and interacted with somebody, whether it's on the street or at a doctor's appointment. It's just so baked in and people don't even realize it, but he really opened my eyes to that. So I first started with my advocacy work fighting for my son's right to a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. And as I said, I continue to advocate for all children, their autonomy, choice, and safety as disabled humans. I work together with my son and Amy. We share lived experience while advocating for disabled children to influence policy at the school board, state, legislators, and national levels. I also sit on the Children's System Advisory Council, Oregon System of Care Legislative Committee, the Oregon Needs Assessment Advisory Panel, the Eugene 4J School District Equity Committee, the Education Justice Action Team, Lane County System of Care. I am trained in Think Kids Collaborative Problem Solving, which is a piece of the trifecta that Amy and I will talk about. And I have worked as a family support specialist and am trained in that. Amy and I have collaborated to create trainings on unpacking systemic ableism and creating safe and supportive school environments for children with disabilities. And I'm also on a national committee that is looking at how to address ableism for blind children in our country.
I feel so validated right now because we're preparing for this interview and I could not get straight all the things you do because you do a lot. You do a lot. But Jenny and Amy, why is Oregon so behind in basic stuff like healthcare, mental health care? What's going on?
I think that one of the biggest things that's going on is that Oregon is really steeped in behaviorism. And I think that's a huge piece of our problem is that we're not looking at what's underlying children's distress behaviors. We tend to look at how to modify those behaviors. And when you do that without understanding what's going on underneath that behavior, oftentimes you're creating more trauma for that child. And then that just perpetuates the issue.
All right. All right. How did you both meet?
Jenny and I met through a parent support group that she is a Facebook moderator of called the A-Team Justice League. And I posted, I don't know, about 9 years ago, probably. It was like in the first year or two that I had moved back to Eugene, saying that I was going to go to the Capitol to testify about a mental health bill. And I don't even remember which one it was. And did anyone want to come with me? And Jenny was the only one that responded. And the next day, or whenever it was, we rode up to Salem together and we kind of trauma bonded over our lived experience as parents and our different situations we've been in. And pretty much we have been partners in advocacy ever since that day.
I have to say that's adorable. You've kind of already touched on it a little bit, but this is such an important point. How did you both come to this work and why?
I never expected to come to this work. I really came into this work because of the painful lived experience that my son and I have navigated together. When my son was little, I was always told that his behavior needed to be modified by using rewards and consequences, and that that was the only way that I would ever be able to get him to live in this world without being institutionalized or dead. Because when he was younger and he was exposed to behaviorism every day in the school setting, he was banging his head into hard objects, and he would do that all the time. And he was treated as if he wasn't a human. He was treated like a dog by all the professionals. And you know, that's one example of how behaviorism is baked into our system. And so the University of Oregon got involved in trying to support my son through the school. And they're very, very behaviorist in their special education department at the U of O. And so they came in and decided that my son needed applied behavior analysis therapy, which people know it as ABA therapy. It's really kind of the root of the behaviorism we see in our schools and in other institutional settings in our system. But it ended up that my son and I both got PTSD from his experience in ABA. He was in a program on the other side of the country at a facility that is considered one of the best places in the world, sent there by the recommendation of the University of Oregon, where they treated these children worse than dogs, very abusive, restraint and seclusion every single day, all the time. And I was there. Most parents never even go with their children there. A lot of these kids come from foster homes. And so I witnessed what was happening there, and I pulled my son out of the program as soon as I could possibly get him safely home. And so that's where it all began for me, really understanding the danger and the horrors of behaviorism.
That's incredible, Jenny. How about you, Amy? How did you come to this work? Why do you do it, and why is it important?
Also through my child, who is now 16, and they have experienced what I call racist ableism in pretty much every setting, misdiagnosis at a young age, misdiagnosis that many Black autistics receive, which is ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, and then ADHD, that led to medical trauma. And in the school system, when we moved back to Eugene, when they were in first grade, they were pushed out of Eugene 4J by second grade. Not wanting other families to go through what we've gone through. And when Jenny talks about the behaviorism, the school version of the behaviorism is called PBI, of like the school version of ABA, which we sometimes call ABA Lite, is PBIS, Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports, which started at the U of O about 30 years ago. Jenny can talk more about ABA's roots, but one of the people who worked under the person who created ABA at the UCLA brought it to the University of Oregon and created the school version, the PBIS. And we believe that what you see in the news with kids kind of blowing out in the classroom and the room clears and all those things, the root of that is the PBIS, because PBIS is based on token economies, rewards and consequences, and planned ignoring, which is also a key part of ABA. And it leads to restraint and seclusion. If you have kids who, especially disabled and neurodivergent kids, who do not, you know, care about the reward because their disability doesn't necessarily, you know, they can't change their sensory issues to earn the cookie or earn the sticker. And nobody's digging under to the to the why or what's happening in our schools are sensory nightmares with our overcrowded classrooms. So talking about this kind of root of the behaviorism, both the ABA that autistic children get on the pipeline for, I guess in some ways, you know, I'm lucky that my kid got a later diagnosis because we weren't pushed into that, but they still got it in the school system. So
I'm so sorry this has happened to your family. This is making my head explode. As a journalist, I spent many years covering the school to prison pipeline, right? And it starts, especially impacting kids of color, especially African-American kids. It starts in preschool, and it's measured by how many kids are put into detention, how many kids are punished at school, and they're like 5 years old. But you are talking about the behavioral pipeline. What is that, and how does it impact us?
On the preschool to prison thing, I just... anecdotally, my kid was written up when they were two in an in-home daycare by two women that had their teaching degrees and were kind of trying to play teacher with young children that weren't developmentally ready to learn in that way.
Okay, I'm breathing. I'm having to do my breathing because that's crazy. Like, what?
Yes. Yeah. No, I pulled them out immediately after that. And their pediatrician was like, they need a t-shirt that says, I'm two.
Yes. And honestly, it's not just a pipeline to prison for a lot of developmentally and intellectually disabled children. They end up in institutions, in institutional settings, which we see a push towards going back to that way. My son is diagnosed with what they call level 3 autism, which means that he requires very significant support. And these kids, people don't even presume competence in these children. So they don't even recognize that they are a thinking, feeling human being, that it has they're intelligent. And so the man who created ABA therapy, Ivar Lovaas, he started this therapy in his laboratory where he would slap autistic children across the face to see if he could get them to stop doing things. And if people were to look it up, there's videos online showing it. It's a trigger warning. It's extremely traumatic to watch. So ABA therapy, which is the root of PBIS, is rotten to the core because the experiments they did on children to see if this therapy would work were horrific. And it works to make children compliant if they can be broken, if their will can be broken. It does not work to make them feel happy and healthy.
You know, I'm very much impacted by ADD and OCD. It took me my whole life to begin to understand the fact that I cannot sit in a chair and be quiet and learn something. I can only learn if I'm moving around. And you can see me right now, I'm moving around. You're rocking my world right now. You're rocking my world right now because I've been a journalist for so long and people have been talking about these issues in education for so long, but they haven't even moved. Like nothing has moved forward with this. I do also have to say, if you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests today are Amy Fellows and Jenny Canaday. They are disability rights advocates at the heart of multiple groups and projects and powerhouses, and they're really schooling us right now. But were you going to say something about that, Amy? Like, how far has
what I was going to say, kind of the ultimate of the institution pipeline is the Judge Rottenberg Center in Massachusetts. Right now, while we speak, there are disabled children being shocked in the name of ABA. In the ultimate compliance training, they wear electric shock devices. It is known that... they kind of trick parents into giving up their parental rights, which actually happens in lots of other settings and happens here in the state of Oregon as well. But at the Judge Rottenberg Center, there's a campaign people can look for with hashtag Stop the Shock. The Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is a national organization that works on policy and disability rights for autistics, is very involved in that Stop the Shock campaign. And, Yeah, it is a absolute human rights violation that has happened every day for, I don't know, I can't remember when it started, but I think probably at least 30 years.
Okay, stop me if I'm wrong, but don't we electrocute people as part of capital punishment? Like in places in the United States where they believe in executions, we shock them. So,
yes.
No, I have to walk on because you guys,
it's
this is challenging. This is really challenging.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. People don't believe us sometimes when we tell them this. And actually, people who say that there's a new ABA, these are behavior analysts, they're talking about how ABA is no longer like that. That stuff doesn't happen anymore. And that's an absolute blatant lie. It is happening right now, as Amy said. So there's this myth about new ABA. And there's no such thing. It's a science.
I have so many questions for you. I have to just put my head down and plow through the questions I have written down because I could rabbit hole on any one of these issues. And thank you for the work you do. Okay, what is the trifecta that you talk about?
Yes. So the trifecta is kind of like, there's no easy solution or perfect answer to these questions. It's very complicated issues, but Amy and I truly believe that this trifecta that we talk about would make a huge difference. We think it would help all children, but especially neurodivergent children and those with trauma. And the first piece is about adult co-regulation. We want to see trainings for adults on how their own nervous systems respond to stress and understand their role as co-regulators with children. Because oftentimes we haven't even processed our own childhood trauma and children can trigger it. And so for us adults to understand what our own triggers are and how to regulate, that is the first step in being able to co-regulate with children. The second thing is sensory safe environments. And this is so huge for neurodivergent humans. There's been plenty of studies that show us that autistic children do not get desensitized to sensory stimuli. And so the behaviorist method of trying to get children to be desensitized, immersion therapy is what they call it, it doesn't work with so many of these autistic children. It just keeps causing more and more distress. So we really want people to understand the sensory systems of neurodivergent humans. They have all these other connections in their brains that we don't have. And that's been proven. And so to understand what that means for them on a sensory level is so important. And also kids who have been impacted by trauma, that changes their sensory system. Things like overcrowded classrooms, fluorescent lights, the feeling of somebody else's distress in the space, that can all be highly impactful on their sensory systems. So addressing that issue is absolutely a must. And the third piece is collaborative problem solving, which is an approach created by Dr. Ross Green. And his theory is children do well when they can. And we believe that's true about children and adults. And that's why we want to train and educate people about all of these things, because the adults also do well when they can. So collaborative problem solving is about working together with that child so that they can practice their own thinking skills instead of being told what to do. They can problem solve together with the adult, which helps build relationship, because relationship is everything when it comes to change. So being able to be on a team with the child and work together and work on looking at what their lagging skills are instead of trying to punish them for behavior that you don't understand.
Were you going to add anything, Amy?
Yes. Oh, I was going to say the reason we know the trifecta works is because it's what we used in our homes when our kids were in crisis, and it kept our kids from being institutionalized. It works, and when the adult does the work, it works.
And we've shared it with many parents who have also come back reported that this lens shift has changed their lives and their family for the better.
How many of the adults working with the kids are impacted by the same issues and don't even know it? Oh, yep. My God. You were going to say something more, Jenny.
Yeah, actually, that is a huge piece of it, is that there's so many adults who are like, when they're learning all this, they're having more grace for themselves. They're realizing that they weren't a bad kid, that there wasn't anything wrong with them, that they're just different and they were misunderstood as children, and oftentimes still as adults.
I love that you're showing it to be we other kids that are different in education. And I think that I was texting with you last week about the Arts Middle School in Portland, Oregon, which has a developmental, I don't even know the right way to describe programs like this, but they have
call them behavior classrooms. They call them behavior classrooms typically.
Right. And most of the Art Magna school above them has no idea they're there. And very much othered. I know we've been talking about this, but I really want to stay on it. Talk a little bit more about the people that your organization serves in general. What are they facing and why is this happening to them? I mean, I know we've touched on these things, but can you tell me like I'm 5 years old?
Yeah. I feel like it impacts all of us, really, because we're all relational creatures. And when we aren't getting our needs met and we aren't understanding our own nervous systems and the nervous systems of our children, it really makes life complicated. And I think that when we look at our society and our culture, behaviorism has been, you know, like I said before, baked in forever. Like, you know, parents did authoritarian parenting for generations. I mean, all of us probably experienced that as children with our parents who didn't know any different or any better. And so this is a culture shift. And culture shifts are hard and they take a long time. But if we can shift this culture away from focusing on modifying behaviors and instead looking at why distress behaviors happen, and seeing behavior as communication and indication of something else, it will impact the entire world. We really feel like this is a way out of a lot of the problems we see politically and societally.
I'm just looking at you. This is a societal shift. It is a societal shift. And part of it is us as adults taking responsibility for our piece in perhaps kids misbehaving. But it's also that maybe us as parents of neurodivergent kids, we maybe have a different goal of our kids being in school than the person at the front of the room does. Do you understand what I'm saying? Can you talk about that a little? Like, do you find that these educators are, I don't even know if educator is the word sometimes, but I mean, are you guys on the same page?
As educators?
The people who are running these behavioral programs that are just insisting that, you know, the kid's behavior has to be modified to fit in with some bigger thing. I mean,
well,
do we have different goals?
Very different goals. For one thing, there is a whole behaviorism industrial complex, or autism industrial complex, or the ABA industrial complex, which is a bazillion dollar private equity funded thing. And we found out a couple years ago through the meetings we're in statewide that Oregon, just with folks on the Oregon Health Plan, a couple years ago, I don't know the current amount, but someone told us that the analysts ran the numbers and Oregon was spending $40 million a year on ABA just for Oregon Health Plan children, not including how much was being spent on private insurance. So there's people who are making money off compliance training and behaviorism. And then, of course, the private prison complex, you know, it feeds. So we're not on the same page as them. With educators, we try to do a lot of relational work to get on the same page. And one of the first trainings that we did actually was for the Eugene Education Association, which is the teachers union for two school districts here. And we did a training where we talked about the trifecta. We talked about kind of sensory safe environments. We talked about, you know, what is neurodiversity and some of those basic things. And it was for the first time, I think there were 60 educators on Zoom, and that was the first time most of them had heard any of it. And it was very well received.
And also, educators are being advised by behavior analysts on how to address behavior in the classroom. And so I don't want to say we're not on the same page as teachers, because we respect and honor teachers, and they are amazing, important, beautiful human beings. But when I go to an IEP meeting with a family and I see that one of the problem behaviors, and I say that in quotes because it's like literally what they call it, that a child is experiencing is crying, and that they want to use a reward system to try to prevent that child from having the problem behavior of crying, I cannot say I'm on board and on the same page with that. And that's just a small example of very common ways that a behaviorist lens looks at children's behavior.
Yeah, because most kids on IEPs that have any externalized behaviors get a FBA,
a functional behavioral assessment
that then kind of feeds the lens that all the adults working with them are looking through.
It almost always says that they're seeking attention or avoiding demands. So with behaviorism, almost always the answer is, well, they need to planned ignoring or redirection, or they are just defiant. So it doesn't ever look at the root of what's going on underneath.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests today are Amy Fellows and Jenny Canaday. They're disability rights advocates at the heart of multiple groups and projects. So for how many people have been put through these programs, right, that we are agreeing are not super fantastic over the generations, right? What happens to our loved ones and colleagues and neighbors who wind up going through this? What happens to them when they're adults?
A lot of times they end up unconsciously perpetuating the problem, living in a way that they have shame and fear because they were never validated and connected with in an authentic way with adults. Amy, do you want to add to that?
Worst case, prison and institutional settings, it's really, if we can shift the culture with our generations, and now is definitely a very hard time to do it, but we also are living through the extreme version of authoritative parenting at the national level and worldwide level. So it's now or never. Like, we need to do it. It's
right.
Time.
Right. I just want to walk back to the trifecta. Mm-hmm. How did you, I know that you said that you figured that out through experiential knowledge, your life experience. No, that's not enough explanation. Did you two just sit there and talk and have coffee and tea over a period of time and then just sit there and think, you know what we should do? What was the story of you coming up with that? Is that somebody else's idea? I think that's your idea.
I mean, I was doing it. I was doing it for years when I met Amy, and I knew that it was the key to saving my son's life. But I hadn't actually been able to like name it. And so that's where Amy comes in.
Did I name it the trifecta? I think all of the things. So for listeners, like if we take each one, the co-regulation, around the same time Jenny and I were really getting to know each other and digging into this work, we were, you know, following people who were like-minded that we found on social media, like leaders in the area, like Dr. Mona De La Hook wrote this amazing book called Beyond Behaviors. It's a parenting book. And then she has a second one out. I can't remember, but there's parent in the name. So following Dr. Mona De La Hook, and then there's a teacher turned educator of teachers, Dr. Lori DeSaltis, who wrote a book called Connection Over Compliance and has since done multiple books. And I think she's in Indiana somewhere in the Midwest, and she teaches teachers and does it virtual so that across the country teachers can come and learn about. That's where they're like, so that kind of, they and others were kind of the co-regulation part that we were learning about. The sensory safe environments, there's a man named Greg Santucci, who's an occupational therapist. We actually brought him last year to Oregon for the Youth IDD Mental Health Summit, which I don't even know if we've talked about yet. But as our keynote speaker, because we really want Oregon to learn from these national leaders so we can undo the behaviorism in Oregon. And so Greg's real focus is sensory safe environments because he's an occupational therapist. And then collaborative problem solving. I took a class through, used to be called the Child Center, it's now called Riverview Center for Growth, I think. But the Oregon Health Authority has funded different organizations in the state to offer free collaborative problem solving trainings. And Riverview is one of them. And I took that class back in like 2016, 17. I think, I don't remember. Jenny took a different collaborative problem solving class. So we kind of both came with, you know, learning about that in our own ways.
For me, a lived experience. It was all a lived experience with my son. I don't know, like, if I would have understood it so quickly and deeply when I started looking at all of these professionals, had I not already been learning it on my own. In, unfortunately, it feels like it was a tragic life for a long time for my family, because I was listening to behaviorists and it was harming my son. And so I just started doing everything that my intuition was telling me to do. I said, I'm not listening to these people anymore. I'm following my intuition. And I believe that it really saved my son. So he was telling me what he needed, and other people were telling me that I should listen to them instead of my mother gut.
It comes back to that thing that you were saying, the autism industrial complex or what have you. Like, it blows my mind. And now we're watching at the federal level when that has kind of captured the federal government, and we don't even know what's going to come from it. And I mean, it's hard to make sense of it, right? But I want
It's terrifying.
In a word, it is terrifying. And that's just this one part of what's happening with Health and Human Services. There's other parts too, which goes to this other interesting issue, you two. Like, there's a place where the mental health overlaps with the physical health. I mean, is it comorbidities? Can you just, there's a lot of people listening to this and light bulbs are going up all over their heads. Can you just talk about that link between the mental and the physical in this setting?
I mean, I think we know that mental distress impacts us physically. I think one thing that we need to catch up on as far as in our healthcare system is a lot of times they still believe that it's all in your head and that's why you have pain. And they're not recognizing that when you have mental distress, it actually does physically impact your body. So the physical pain is also just as real as the mental pain, because that's how deeply they're connected.
When all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yes.
I want to shift and talk into your talk more about behaviorism and your unpacking systemic ableism training. And also at the same time, if we can find out more about the Youth IDD Mental Health Summit, these things that you do, tell us about them.
Yeah. So I don't even remember. I was trying to remember the first time that we did the training. For for We Can Do Better last year, instead of doing our annual conference, we did a disability justice speaker series that was 4 parts. And we wanted to kind of bring these concepts as part of that. So we were the last part of the speaker series. And that's the first time we did this unpacking systemic ableism training. But since then, we have led it for ODHS child welfare staff down in kind of the Lane County region, not
Oregon Department of Health,
Oregon Department of Health, Human Services.
There you go. Okay.
So yeah, so child welfare, the people that go and you know, check in on children when there's abuse allegations and that kind of thing, and work in the foster care system. We've done it for Oregon Family Support Network's Advocacy and Policy Academy for parents, and at last year's Youth IDD Mental Health Summit, and it was well received, and we're doing it again this year, in next month in August 6th as a breakout session, and we are in conversation with other community groups to do the training. But so the training really is about a lot of the things that we've been talking about, and is a combination of our lived experience and kind of the history of disability in this country, things like the ugly laws, some of the really awful roots, but clearly the roots aren't done because we still have the Judge Rottenberg Center. So we talk about that also. We talk about behaviorism. We talk about the neurodiversity movement and what is, you know, neurodivergence and kind of what falls under the neurodivergent umbrella and things like that. And just really trying to bring awareness of the baked in ableism that's in all of our systems to help make them safer for people.
The Youth IDD Mental Health Summit, what does IDD stand for and what are you doing there?
It stands for Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. And it is a conference that's been going on for a number of years. The last couple of years, the ARC of Oregon has been kind of the backbone organization. And Jenny and I joined last year on the conference, you know, on the planning, the summit planning committee, and kind of brought a lot of these ideas, you know, got Greg Santucci to come to Oregon this year because of HB 3835 that we haven't dug into yet, but it's
let's
one of
do
the
that next,
big,
yeah.
big bills this session that involved restraint and seclusion and changing the rules around what constitutes abuse. We were motivated to ask Guy Stevens from the Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint, and they have a website in seclusion.org. To be the keynote speaker because it was clear that Oregon is stuck down in a way it feels like that these children are animals and that they have to be contained, restrained, and secluded. But also like not getting that the behaviorism leads to adult child power struggles, which is what leads to the very big escalated behaviors that lead to restraint and seclusion being needed. So I feel like we're kind of stuck in that, like, it has to always happen. And there's always going to be, you know, safety reasons. Like, you would grab a kid that's running out in the street, you know, you would stop somebody that is doing self-harm, you know, in a way that needs to be safely stopped. But so we thought it was important to bring Guy to Oregon and really dig into that conversation about other approaches for supporting children and having a national expert talk about that. And the summit is August 6th. It's at Oregon State University. We also will have the keynote from Guy Stevens, Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint, will be virtual, as well as our closing keynote is Senator Gelzer Blowen, who is a real champion for the disability community. And she's doing the closing keynote at the summit that will also be available virtually. It is sliding scale to free because we want to make sure that parents are able to access it or people whose jobs wouldn't pay for them to go to a conference. Traditionally, this summit was kind of mental health providers learning about the intellectually and developmentally disabled community. But in the last couple of years, we really wanted to kind of everybody who wraps around the children. So educators, the DSPs and PSWs, which are the support workers that support people with developmental disabilities in their homes and community, mental health providers, of course, you know, kind of, who am I leaving out, Jenny, but just kind of everybody who wraps around.
Yeah, parents and families, because one of the things we see happening is that the interventions that families receive from the system are often either telling the parent to use behaviorism on their child, or they're actually training parents in a way that they become behaviorist in order to interact with their child. There's some interventions. One is called parent-child interactive therapy. And I believe that starts out with like a behavior specialist having a earbud in the parent's ear, kind of telling them how to have a transactional relationship with their child, because behaviorism is transactional. It's about, I'll give you this if you do this. If you're good, you get this. And it's always reliant on extrinsic motivation. And so what we want to see is people looking at trying to create authentic connections with children, because relationships build intrinsic motivation. And intrinsic motivation is what changes the world. And also kind of addresses capitalism, if you want to get into that. But that's another conversation for another day.
Right. But I mean, capitalism, I mean, if we just define that as a tendency to try to privatize and make money off of every single thing that moves in our society, it sounds like that, just that, I could even say privatization instead of capitalism, it sounds like that's a big part of what's driving it. And there's got to be so many moving parts to do something about. Just looking at that, unpacking that industry would be really, really interesting. But we want to dig into what happened with the state legislative bill. Can you, what was that? What was the number? What happened with it? What would it have done?
So it was HB House Bill 3835. It was drafted through the System of Care Advisory Council, which is a governor-appointed council with system leaders of all the various systems that really our most vulnerable children are involved in. But so ODHS, like the Child Welfare Foster System, DDS, Developmental Disability Systems, ODE, the Oregon Department of Education, OHA, Children's Behavioral Health, you know, all these different system leaders, as well as like the residential placement facilities that kids and teenagers with big distress behaviors end up being placed in. And then there are lived experience seats also on the council, and then there's a variety of committees. Jenny and I both sit on the legislative committee for SOCAC, and that's how we first learned about this bill back in December, this last December, as preparing for the session. And so they work closely with ODHS, child welfare, in the drafting of the bill. And it was a 110-page bill, very big, did a lot of different things. Was very hard to track them all, but the things that really caught our attention and concern was it redefined what constitutes abuse when it comes to restraint and seclusion. And currently, prone restraint and supine restraint, so prone is face down and supine is on your back, are both considered wrongful restraints in Oregon. It would have undone that and not made it wrongful.
They're wrongful, also, very dangerous.
Yes, kids die in prone restraint, especially the face down. Also, I'm sure you saw a few years ago the big issues with many of Oregon's foster kids being sent to out-of-state placements. One of those out-of-state placements, a teenage boy died in a prone restraint while we had Oregon foster kids at that same place. Then our Girls Are Blowing is really someone who went and looked at all these various places and saw the horrors that were happening at many of them, and that nobody was checking on them from ODHS, and brought you know, changed legislation and brought the kids back to Oregon. So this bill is kind of was a response to that in a bit, because now we have, you know, we have other issues with kids in hotel rooms with ODHS staff and other things. However, this bill was not the answer, because it basically was about liability. There were two big lawsuits, one with Disability Rights Oregon and one with CASA, the court-appointed special advocates, against ODHS, the state of Oregon Child Welfare, for the treatment of foster youth. Both, the state lost both of them. And there have been other abuse allegations, lawsuits from, you know, individuals and families, and many. So the state has paid out a lot of money and lost cases for abusing children. The concerning thing that the, I think it was the CASA lawsuit, there was a special master's report with recommendations from the judge. Those recommendations were not found in HB 3835. And so the concern was that this is really about liability for the state and not about protecting children. So we and other parent advocates and the disability advocacy organizations like Disability Rights Oregon had a very strong campaign all session opposing this bill. Jenny was asked to be on a panel at the second public hearing with the Disability Rights Oregon attorney and a former foster youth advocate. So it kind of took over our lives for about 6 months. It did end up dying, I think, because there was enough controversy raised. There were several news articles and OPB and the Oregonian about it. So it did end up dying the last week of the session, but we know that what was trying to be accomplished will likely come back. And there's other places, there's other state work groups and things where, you know, the fight isn't over. But through this, I think we kind of have started to build our army. We made connections with attorneys that, you know, worked for foster youth and other parent advocates and disability self-advocates. So I don't know, Jenny, you can add.
Yeah, I think that during our efforts to inform people about House Bill 3835, one of the frustrating things was we kept getting asked, well, what do we do instead? And Amy and I would tell them every single time, here's an idea. Here's this trifecta. This is upstream work. And we need to focus on it and training people to understand and all these things that we just keep saying over and over again. And then their response would be, well, yeah, but what can we do instead? As if they didn't even hear us say what we said. And I feel like that's just something that happens over and over again, is people are so focused on looking downstream at managing and modifying behavior that they don't realize that if you get upstream, you don't see those behaviors, at least not as often, not nearly as often. And so I did sit on a panel with Disability Rights Oregon, because as I told you, my son was in that program on the other side of the country that was an ABA program that was horribly abusive. And when I was there with him, there were almost all foster kids that didn't have families visiting them. And one of the things that Oregon was saying is they were going to send foster kids there, but they were going to send people to check on them. Well, they were supposed to send somebody to scout out the place my son went, but they did not end up doing that. And so I wanted to testify to the fact that just because they say that they're going to do something, that doesn't necessarily mean that it'll happen. And it was a bit frustrating because I was getting pushback. Well, this has nothing, your son has nothing to do with this, because this is about foster kids. And once again, I would say most of those kids were foster kids and nobody was there for them. And I don't even know what happened to them. And they would just kind of redirect it back to, well, this is about foster kids. So there's a lot of, it feels like people maybe choosing not to hear us, or subconsciously choosing not to hear us.
Yes. And the bill was not just about foster kids. It also addressed ODDS group homes.
Yes.
You know, that developmentally disabled youth RA. So it was changing the rules for that also. It was not just about foster kids, but there also was this thing like, why shouldn't we care about foster kids? Like, they're all of our children. All the children are all of our children. But there was, we would get this pushback about, why do you care about this? It's about foster kids. And that's not, you don't have foster kids. So
Also, the percentage of kids in foster care that are intellectually and or developmentally disabled is extremely high.
You both, yes. Can I ask you, who was behind this bill? I mean, I know that's a hard question, but who promoted it? Who introduced it?
It was a bipartisan sponsored bill with Rep. Ramnos and Rep. Deal.
All right, I have to change gears because we're starting to run out of interview. All the work that you've done, has anything surprised you about these issues? Or are there any myths about them? We're sort of talking about the myths, but do you have any, oh my God, moments?
I think one of the myths is that, for me, I'm very passionate about ABA because I do believe it's the root. And when we look at the root, we can dig it out for all the other spaces. One of the myths is that there's a new ABA, that it's no longer abusive. That is a myth. That is not true. There's a myth that people who are advocating to abolish ABA are anti-parents and judge parents who put their children in ABA. That is not true. I am a parent who put my child in ABA. I do not judge parents. I just want them to have informed consent.
I want to pre-apologize because I'm going to spend the rest of my life nagging both of you to write a book about it. I'm doing it. I'm just going public. I'm holding myself accountable. I do want to apologize. Do you need a book? We need this. I mean, I've interviewed literally 1,000 people. Rarely do I meet people who have totally original ideas to absolutely intractable issues, and that is you. How can our listeners support your work?
Well, they can contact us directly. My email is amy@wecandobetter.org. And
yeah, my email is azaneylife@gmail.com.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, my very, very, very last question is, what is the single most important thing that you want all of our listeners to carry away from this conversation that we've just had?
I would say that focusing on connection over correction when it comes to our children will change the world. It's much bigger than I think a lot of people even understand. Amy and I aren't just focused on changing our school system or our systems. We're focused on making the world a better place where people aren't in distress as much as they are now, where people feel understood, supported, and connected in relationship.
What do you think, Amy? Like, if you're talking to my sister, yeah, okay. Kind of the thing that I'm taking away from this convo is that there are people who are not paid a whole bunch of money who have a lot of insights on this issue, and they're not being heard because the people who are being paid a lot of money make a lot of noise. And that's what I'm taking away from it. The thing that really amazes me about what you're saying too is that I don't know if I've ever really thought about these behavioral health situations that involve kids and adults who are teachers, or I don't even know what other capacity, people who are supposed to be taking care of the kids. And it's just that somehow these adults see themselves as better than the kids, but maybe they actually have the same issues and they don't even know. So if you did get, as part of the trifecta, if you did get the caregivers, the teachers in these special ed and other sorts of situations, if you gave them the chance to learn how this all works, they might actually find something out about themselves, actually, which is, this happens with these issues. All right. It was such a joy talking with you. This interview is just really unusually informative, and I just want to thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you. Lisa. Thanks for having us on your show and for doing such an amazing show.
Yes, thank you.
This is Keeping It Real. Our guests today have been Amy Fellows and Jenny Canaday. And Amy, you have a website, right? What is your website address?
Oh, wecandobetter.org.
Yes, that's it. And
connect with her. You can connect with her online.
Yes.
Special thanks to the entire KBOO Community Radio staff for making this all possible. KBOO Community Radio needs more volunteers. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. You can make a contribution to support programming like this at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, where you can listen to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m.